This has been a tough week for our country. I know that my heart is hurting, and I know there are lots of hearts out there that are hurting. And, you know, we can use our pain for good. So may that knowing be so for all of us. And, you know, I firmly believe that we can make a huge difference through our spiritual teachings, our spiritual practices, our spiritual knowing. That really, when big things happen in the world where we are jarred awake once again, that it is that spiritual foundation and those spiritual knowings that really are needed in the world. So it's a call for all of us to step up. So in this week three of our series, Transforming the Seven Vices into Virtues, I've done a little revisioning and I've claimed prejudice as one of those vices and the ensuing virtue as freedom. And that's what happens over time, that as a species, we evolve and some of these guidelines that we create for ourselves evolve as well. And I think we're in sore need of transformation around this particular one. So today we're going to tackle prejudice. Specifically, we're going to focus in on racial prejudice. And then we'll move into that corresponding virtue of freedom. So first, we have to look at how do we fit into this all? What's my part in it? And I'm drawing today from an old tale. It's often accredited to a Thai folk tale. You may have heard it before. And it goes like this. One day, the king and his chief advisor were having a conversation on the balcony of the palace over rice cakes topped with honey. And the king went to point to something in the distance right at the edge of the balcony, and as he did so, his rice cake tipped and a drop of honey fell on the side of the balcony. And the advisor said, "O king, you dropped some honey. Shall we call a servant to clean it up?" And the king said, "Ha! A drop of honey? Not my problem. Don't worry about it." And so they began to continue to talk and to eat their rice cakes with honey and sip their tea and enjoy their afternoon. But the advisor was really keyed into what was going on, and he noticed that the honey, when it was warmed by the sun, dropped all the way down to the street and was now attracting some flies. And so he said, "Sire, don't you think we should probably call someone to clean the honey up? Now it's attracting flies." And the king said, "Oh, a few flies, please. That is not my problem." And so they continued on in their way of enjoying each other's company and their food. But then the advisor noticed that a little lizard came out of a crack in the wall, and it began to eat up all those flies with its tongue. And it attracted a cat from over in the baker's bakery. And so the cat went, and it began to play with the lizard like a toy. And then out of the butcher shop ran the dog, and the dog bit the cat's neck. And so now an animal fight was ensuing. And the advisor pointed out to the king, "O king, a lizard came out and started eating those flies, and then a cat came from the bakery, and now the dog came from the butcher, and there is a big fight going on downstairs right below the balcony." And the king said, "Oh, I don't have time to worry about an animal fight. Not my problem. Surely someone will see it." Well, indeed, the baker did see that her cat's neck was in the mouth of the butcher's dog. And so she ran out with a rolling pin and she began to hit the dog. And the butcher ran out with a broom and he began to hit the baker's cat. And so then people around the town noticed that there was a fight because the two then began hitting one another with the broom and the rolling pin. And others came out and some knew the baker better and some knew the butcher better. And so they began to take sides and everybody began to join in the fight. And then some soldiers came along and some of them knew the butcher and some of them knew the baker. And so that they too began to take sides. And an enormous village war started to take place. Everybody was fighting with each other, yelling at each other, hitting each other. Pretty soon people started throwing rocks through windows. Somebody took one of the torches and lit one of the buildings on fire. And soon the whole village was in flames and it moved toward the palace and the palace itself caught fire. Before they knew it, the advisor and the king were being escorted down a ladder from the balcony to escape the palace. The whole thing was in ruins. And so the king, then walking along with his advisor, surveying now the ruins of their land, noticed something, a golden puddle of honey. Huh, maybe I should have cleaned that up, the king thought. And that was the last time that the king ever said, "It's not my problem." Maybe the king was also learning a lesson about oneness. Our actions and our inactions affect everyone if we believe that we are one. If we are one, then when one kills, we all kill. When one dies, we all die. When one hurts, we all hurt. And when one heals, we all heal. When one awakens, we all awaken. So let us be the ones who take that step and begin to heal and awaken. And then lo and behold, we all heal. We all awaken. You know, ministry is thought often to exist to comfort the afflicted. And certainly that is a part of what ministry is about. But there's a flip side to that, to afflict the comfortable. And the latter might be where we find ourselves a little bit more today in our message. So, you know, I think one of the questions we can ask ourselves is, do I really, really believe in this spiritual idea of oneness? Do I really believe it as more than just a spiritual platitude? It's easy for us to speak affirmations as sort of platitudes and to sing songs that hold those beliefs, but the rubber hits the road when we start to practice in the real world. And when we start to practice in the real world, can we still hang on and understand the reality of what oneness is? Can we hold that oneness is something that can indeed be felt and experienced by all with whom we say we are one? And do we truly want to embody divine love? Because it's a big charge. To say that we want to embody divine love, to be the very presence of divine love in the world, it's a high calling. And there are probably different stages along the way in which we will evolve, if we continue on the path, to embody more and more of that divine love. But what divine love does, what the essence of God does, is move toward that which needs to be healed. It moves toward the pain. Not away. It moves toward that which needs to be restored to wholeness. And so if we truly want to embody divine love, we must look. We must be willing to be witnesses to the pain of the world so that we can then be the presence of love and healing, so that we can be a part of the resolution that needs to happen for all of us. So are you ready? I mean, are you really ready? Are we ready? I'm asking myself too, am I really ready to step up and to step in and to look and to do the tough inner work? Daniel Namod has a song to warm us up. Get ready, my soul. Let's watch.
Get ready, my soul. I'm diving in. Get ready, my soul. I'm diving in to Get ready. Get ready, my soul. Everything I've ever done, everything I've ever seen, everything I've lost or won, everything I've ever dreamed has brought me here to the present moment, here to a new beginning here, and I'm seeing life so clearly now. Get ready, my soul. I'm diving in. Get ready, my soul. I'm diving in to the deepest kind of love, to the sweetest kind of life. Get ready. Get ready, my soul. 'Cause here I go, deeper, deeper, deeper than I've ever been before. Here I go, closer, closer, closer to my sacred source. Here I go, deeper, deeper, deeper than I've ever been before. Here I go, closer, closer, closer to my sacred source. Here I go, than I've ever been before. Here I go, closer, closer, closer to my sacred source. Get ready, my soul. I'm diving. Get ready, my soul. I'm diving in to the deepest kind of love, to the sweetest kind of life. Get ready, get ready, my soul. Get ready, get ready, my soul.
Right, and so we are ready, or ready as we'll ever be, as we like to say. So while this message is intended to be for the benefit of all of us, when it comes to race, the locus of change really rests with those of us who are white. There, I said it. So let's take a wider view of what society looks like. Marilyn Frye, the scholar, gives us this metaphor of the birdcage. She says, imagine that you're up against a birdcage and you're able to just press your face in such a way that you can see the bird almost unobstructed. And from this view, you would wonder, why the bird doesn't just fly away. In fact, even if you turn your head a little bit and you could just examine one of those bars, you would see that there's only one thing that stands in the bird's way, and it would be easy for it to fly around. It's not until that we step all the way back and look, we see all the crisscrossed bars all the way around the cage that encloses the bird, that keeps it from being able to fly. And see, that is very much that pattern, that interlocking pattern taken as a whole, is very much what the society has created, a kind of barrier that doesn't, and so many interlocking barriers, institutional barriers, that they all work together to create the one cage, to hold that cage in place. And so one of the ways that we hold the cage in place, that we all are complicit in helping to hold this cage in place, is through our silence. Robin DiAngelo, who's the author of White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Race, shares examples like these. Uncle Joe tells a racially biased story, and nobody wants to say anything, and so we don't say anything because nobody ever interrupts Uncle Joe from telling his big, boisterous stories, and besides, we don't want to ruin the family dinner. Or we go to a neighborhood barbecue, and one of our neighbors tells a racial joke, and we don't say anything. In fact, maybe even we nervously laugh. But we don't say anything, or we nervously laugh, because, well, we don't want to upset the apple cart, right? And we don't want to be told to lighten up or that we're too politically correct. Something's going on in our work that looks like racial bias to us, but we don't want to say anything because, well, we don't want to be seen as not being a team player, or we don't want anything to get in the way of our career advancement. You see how it goes, how we all participate in holding the birdcage together. None of us want to be considered racist, and most of us individually probably aren't. But taken as a whole, the problem as a world is the fear that keeps that in place trumps our spiritual qualities. It trumps our values. And so there is a compression going on of what we have to offer, of what we believe, of who we think we are, of the oneness, of the love, of the peace and the harmony that we want, that we say, that we envision, that we hold. And so sometimes our prayers have to have feet. They have to have action. We have to be the ones who are brave enough to call it out. Otherwise, it just stays just as it is. And we sit around like a king in our palace and say, it's not our problem. So prejudice, there are two truths, really, two basic truths that can help us move along in this way. And the first is to recognize that we all have prejudices. We all have prejudices. Just like last week when we talked about the vice of anger, we all feel anger. It's part of our human makeup. And we're all going to have prejudices. The definition in the dictionary of a prejudice is a preconceived opinion, often about another person's group membership, that is not based on fact or actual experience. So we get it from the media, we get it from our families, we get it from, you know, whatever. We form these ideas and we hold these prejudices until we look, until we examine them, until we're willing to question ourselves. Implicit bias is a little bit more helpful because it gets really closer to the spiritual work. Implicit bias refers to attitudes or stereotypes that affect our understanding, our actions, and our decisions in an unconscious manner. So we know from our metaphysical understanding, you might know the three phases of mind, the unconscious, the conscious, and the superconscious. And so when something is in our unconscious, there's this implicit bias in our unconscious. We don't even realize we have it until we look and see that we do. And then it's brought into the conscious light. There's no shame in that. It's just, you know, it's something that we hold until we know. And then when we know, we can do something about it. Then it's now here it is in the conscious light of day. And part of what helps us bring it from unconscious to conscious is the work of the superconscious, whether it's up above or outside or deep within us. You know, it's that divine consciousness. And so we can invoke that, call upon that, pray for that to help us, to guide us, to show us, so that we truly understand, that we truly see whatever it is that we need to see. As I was preparing for this talk, I went for a walk in what has become one of my favorite places to walk. And it's also a place where I get challenges, oddly enough. I've been dealing with about 7 weeks of poison oak that I got up in that area. And about 15 months ago, I broke my arm in that area. But these are teachings for me too, as it always is for us, right? So I was just holding this intention, and I turned my walk into a ceremony, and you can do that really easily by making a threshold and holding an intention. It's very much what we do in our nature immersions. And then crossing that threshold and knowing you're entering into a ceremony now. You've brought in the superconscious mind. You've called forth the divine consciousness to guide you. And so I invoked that. And then I crossed the threshold. And I was getting warm, so I took off my hoodie and was tying it around my waist. And I heard Spirit say, yes, get naked. Well, I wasn't going to get naked. I was in a public place. But I got the message, right? It's about stripping down, letting go, you know, just opening up. And then immediately I was going uphill, and the winds picked up, and so the wind was against me. And I thought about how, you know, that's part of what happens sometimes on the spiritual path. It's not always easy, right, to really walk our talk. It's not always easy, but so there was all this, you know, symbolic stuff happening that was showing me the resistance. And then I got to the path to turn, and of course it was, as it turns out, very narrow, and there were weeds on both sides, and I thought, oh no, I don't want more poison oak. But I really felt guided to keep going, so I did. And about 3/4 of the way down, I felt this, like, just turn your head. And I turned and I looked to the sky. And the sky was really beautiful. And there was openness and there was blues and clouds. And I got the word freedom. And I realized the virtue that we were talking about is freedom. That prejudice can be transformed into freedom for all of us. So as I was coming down the hill then, I walked actually all the way out the gate and thought that was the threshold and that I was done with my ceremony. But I looked back and I felt called back in. And there that was, the narrow gate open. So I walked through the narrow gate and I realized I never did sit in that place where I had broken my arm. And so I just sat down and I was in that space for a little bit. I sat down in the middle of the path, right where I had been with my dog, Chaos, who has since made his doggy transition. And as I sat there, I remembered what a friend told me that about shamanic ceremony and how bones are broken, like often they're animal bones of animals that have already died, but they will break the bones in the ceremony to release the energy. And I thought about that and how my arm breaking was a release of energy. And it was also a release of ways of shouldering things that obscure my, shouldering too many detailed things and to-dos. And it's obscuring my going deeper within myself. But also, just for us collectively, it felt like that breaking of bones. You know, it's in our bones to know what is right. It's in our bones to want all of us to be free. We know this as human, divine beings. We know the truth in our bones. We long for things to be righted, to be harmonious, to be loving. And so that release was just a way of letting go of that old energy that says, I can't or I don't know how, because neither is true. So I went back through that narrow gate, and just as I look back, I saw up on the hill this beautiful dead tree, or naked tree, maybe it's not dead, but it was so beautiful in that nakedness and in that maybe dying, that idea that it can still hold this beauty. So whatever it is that needs to die away, there's a beauty in the process. There's a beauty in the shedding. There's a beauty in the breaking open and the releasing. I guess what I'm saying is we don't have to be afraid. So that's the first truth, recognizing that we all have prejudices. We all have work to do. And the second truth is to recognize that in our society, if we are white or of European descent, that we have privilege. So what that means is privilege is defined as a societal advantage of being seen as the norm. Think of it this way. You know, the norm, like as a white person, I am a round peg that fits in a round hole. I know the game. I know the rules. I know how it works to fit in that round hole. But imagine if you were a square peg and you were told that you had to fit into the round hole, that culturally you didn't totally fit into that. But these are the rules of the game. And so you try your very best to fit into that round hole. But then you're told, but you look like a square peg, so you can't fit in the round hole. You see the game? The rules aren't fair. You can never win in that game. And we want a game that all of us can win. We want a game of life with a capital L that all of us can win. We claim it, we know it, and now we can really do the inner transformation that can help our brothers and sisters and all people and all life thrive in that understanding of freedom and oneness and capital L life, living fully. So we can help the world by taking off our own blinders and looking for the prejudice and acknowledging the privilege that is. And then we can envision together the new world that we want to build and actually take action to do so. And there might be some of us that are afraid of losing privilege, but why would we? We know, too, that we live in a world that is abundant, that there is no lack or limitation. There is no small amount in the divine for life, for freedom, for good, for privilege. It's available then for all of us. It's no longer privilege. It just is. It just is the gift of life that God wants all of us to have, that we are meant to have, that we are wired to have. And so there's no fear in losing your privilege. It's more like sharing. And you know how great it feels to share, that things exponentially grow, that the goodness keeps on growing, like our principles of abundance. No one has to lose. We all can win in the game of life. We just need to make sure the rules are fair and clear for everyone. We can take our cue from rats. You know, in experiments, and experiment after experiment, not just rats, but several types of rodents, will actually free other rats that are imprisoned, even if there's no reward to do so. And so that divine impulse of compassion, that divine impulse to want everyone to thrive and to be free, it's in the rats, and it's in our DNA too. We are just as worthy as they are, of demonstrating that divinity. Some of you know Jabari Anderson. He's a member of our Unity of Walnut Creek community. He sometimes sings for us, really inspired singing. He's an opera singer as well, a trained opera singer, just a little extra fact. But Jabari, you might know also, is a black man. And I was speaking to him the other day, and he said, "Who is the prisoner and who is the warden?" He said, "I've been called the N-word countless times." And he said that I respond using my spiritual practices. He said, "I lean on heart math and I know neuroscience, and I don't want that toxicity of anger in my system." He said, "I've seen the water molecules when they're in the presence of anger and how they're grossly, you know, shaped." He said, "I don't want that happening inside my body." And so I pause and I allow myself not to judge. And he said, "And I pray for those who persecute me because they're unhappy." And I say to you, Jabari, and to all those people of color who are listening, practice of Ho'oponopono comes to mind. I am sorry. Please forgive me. Thank you. I love you. To believe in oneness and freedom for all is a constant inner practice, a living, breathing edict. It's work. It's not just, and there is joy in it, but it's not just all fun. It's not just all joy. It's work that takes us there. We have to be not afraid of the inner work, or we won't get that far on our spiritual journey, and we won't contribute as much as we could have in our lifetime. This is what Jesus spoke of when he talked about the narrow gate, of entering the narrow gate. He was talking about, I think, about the narrow gate of real spiritual work. And he said, enter through the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the road is easy that leads to destruction. And there are many who will take it. For the gate is narrow, and the road is hard that leads to life, and there are few who find it. Let us be those who find it. Let us be those who are willing to walk through the narrow gate. And we can do this by seeking to understand, by inquiring within, what are my blinders? What don't I understand yet? And if you are white or of European descent, what does it mean to be white? What does that mean? What does it look like to be white? What does my race mean? What does this identity that I have mean for me and for all of us? And pray, guiding, asking Spirit to guide you through a process. What do I need to see? What needs to be revealed in me? Reveal it, oh God, through me and as me, so that I may see for myself whatever is next for me. And we can learn. You know, we're smart people. We know how to learn about all kinds of things. We know how to get on the internet and Google stuff. Google it. Google white privilege. Google Black Lives Matter. Google Black history. Google implicit bias. Google institutionalized racism. It doesn't really matter where you start. You're going to find a plethora of resources, things to read, films to watch, ways that we can educate ourselves. And then finally, we can connect, right? By reaching out into the community, we can get involved in our local interfaith subgroups. We can, you know, join things like Surge, showing up for racial justice. And we can have conversations about race with all kinds of folks of varied racial backgrounds. So we can seek to understand in all of those ways, and we can also break the complicit silence by not just remaining silent when we see racial bias, when we hear jokes, when we hear stories or comments, but call them out with bravery. Let's not be like the kings and the queens in our palace, thinking that our contribution to things doesn't matter, doesn't have an impact. We need to clean up our own mess, our own inner prejudices, our own inner blinders in places in which we don't see, and stop saying it's not my problem or acting like it isn't. We are a part of one world. We are one. We are part of one divine presence. As we, one of us awakens, we are all lifted up. Call upon Spirit to reveal whatever needs to be revealed for you, and it will be revealed. It doesn't have to all happen at once. It can happen at our own pace, in our own way. Sometimes we need to put a face on things to know who it is that we're practicing for. I remember being in a spiritual retreat once, a meditation retreat, and somebody said, sometimes it just helps to know who you're practicing for. And immediately the face of my godson, Seth, came to mind, and it gave me impetus to keep going. Or sometimes it's my goddaughter, Grace. But for you, whatever that face is, maybe of a little one, a neighbor, a friend, a grandchild, that we practice for them so that they may inherit freer, kinder, a more equitable world, that we can do our best to give over to them the kind of world we want them to have, the kind of life we want them to have. And one of those faces that I can't get out of my mind now, and maybe you won't either, and I don't want to, I hold Kedron Bryant in my heart. I want him to have more than a life of survival. I want him to have a full life and a free life filled with creativity and his gift of song. Kedron's a 12-year-old gospel singer, and the events this week inspired his mother, Janetta, to write this song and for Kedron to sing it and really owns it as his own. So today, we're going to close out with Kedron's song, I Just Want to Live. Let's watch together.
I'm a young black man doing all that I can to stand. Oh, but when I look around and I see what's being done to my kind every day, I'm being hunted as prey. My people don't want no trouble. We've had enough, Shango. I just want to live. God, protect me. I just want to live. I just want to live.